Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode is brought to you by Bibliophiles, a production of the Center for Lit podcast network, where the Andrews family brings the great ideas of Western literature to bear on the life, art, and culture of our modern world. Look for Bibliophiles, that's Bibliophiles with an F, wherever you get your podcasts, or find curriculum materials, online classes, and book clubs at centerforlit.com.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you were listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the Incurable Reader, on which we are discussing William Faulkner's As They Lay Dying, and Tim is making distracting faces. Have we ever gone over the professional
rhythm of this podcast? I wish you guys could see this.
He looks like one of those big floppy balloons with arms that's like at a outside of a car dealership.
Like a Rose Bowl parade? Oh,
no,
yeah.
Like the balloon man. What is that guy called?
No, not like,
Lucy got me like a little one for Christmas in my stocking because I'm like obsessed with those things. I think they're hilarious. And I drive like really whenever I see them. But I don't know what they're called.
They're kind of wonderful,
aren't
they?
They're like a windsock man.
Yeah, windsock man.
Okay,
windsock man.
Tim, you looked like a windsock man, is what I was trying to say. Like.
Thank you.
You got the build for
it. I went to Rose Bowl. What?
It's a compliment.
You look like a giant sock with hardly any features.
Are you suggesting that I'm like limber and flexible?
Yes. Yes, that is exactly what I am suggesting.
Increasingly so as you get older.
What? I feel like, again, another podcast begins with a kind of rout of Tim's feelings.
No, I think she was actually trying to be nice to you.
An attack.
No, it was. It was not an attack.
It's another attack.
You were the one that did windsock man movements.
I feel like you opened yourself up and I said you've got the build for it, which is a way of saying, I don't know, like a basketball build, you know, tall, limber.
That makes sense.
Lean.
Yeah. Kind of stretchy.
Stretchy. Yes.
Yeah.
Lean, stretchy.
Yeah. Tim, you have a basketball build.
Yep. Windsock
Thank
man
you.
Build.
So we are here to discuss. What are we here to discuss? Oh, yeah. As They Lay Dying. We're in the third of four sections. This ends with Mosley's POV. In my edition, the hardcover Modern Library edition, it is page 182. So we're coming down to it. You know, sometimes we talk on this show, we'll say things like, well, you know, maybe not a lot happened on this episode, but here's why it's, or this section, here's why it still matters. Well, this is one of those episodes where so much happened. Just
this
a lot of stuff happened.
Episode.
Everything happened.
There's a river crossing. There's a broken leg. We learn stuff about Dewey Dell. There's more mom fish stuff. So just a lot happens. And yet I feel the need to begin in a particular place. Because earlier today we were texting. And Tim and I received a text from Heidi White. And it was the kind of text that one brings up on a podcast as an entryway into a conversation. I'm going to read.
It was a private glimpse into my inner life. Now you're.
Well, I'm going to read this private glimpse into Heidi's inner life. She meant it to be private, and yet I'm still going to share
it with
thousands of people.
Does it begin with ga?
Yeah, it begins with ga. Can you do that? Could you do a live rendering of that for us, Heidi?
Gah. It's even more intense than just ga.
Okay.
Like it has like a gah. Like it's NG.
Okay, got it. She then followed up that exclamation with the following sentence. I want to crawl into this book and punch ants in the throat.
Oh that my was, gosh, I so do.
To which Tim responded, no doubt. classic Tim fashion, all caps, exclamation point. So the two of you have violent feelings, and we're going to work that out on today's episode, as one does when one reads As I Lay Dying. Heidi, why do you want to crawl into this book and punch ants in the throat?
Because he's a horrible, horrible man. And I had...
Other than that, no reason.
Yeah, like I just...
Well, that's the
I
end of this week's show.
Person who knocked out his teeth and makes him need new teeth. Except that's what makes him such a jerk. Like, he's so awful. He's so... He's like selfish and... He gives people so much trouble, and then he acts like he's being nice, and then he stands there while his wife's coffin's turning over in water, and then his kid almost dies, and he's just the worst. He's the worst.
Well, he doesn't have any arms or legs. Oh, wait, no, that's teeth. Sorry.
That's wind sock.
He doesn't have teeth. He has arms and legs. He just... Tim, you
I
said...
I think what you makes agreed. Him so... Oh man, what makes him so just revolting is that he does all the things that Heidi just said. He kind of like sidelines everything, doesn't do anything. And then to make matters worse, he plays the victim. Mm-hmm. Mm. Like, oh, his like, you know, I'm the one who's just being done wrong here. And you're just like, dude, get a job. Go get a job.
Yep.
Oh, you're a get a job guy, huh?
I'm a get a job guy. I mean, when they want to go get a water bucket after they've passed through the town, they've made it across the river miraculously, and they want to go get a water bucket, and he's like, I don't want to be beholden to anybody. And you're like, what are we talking about here, man? Just man. Like, I don't want to be beholden to like borrowing or even, yeah, a water bucket? To water our animals?
He sold Jules' horse. When like someone volunteered and offered to loan him this team. You can't sell Jules' horse. You know what Jules went through to get that horse? I know Jules' an ass. I know that. But This is his father. No.
Yeah, it's not though. Yep.
Yeah. Ooh, right. That's a good point. Does ants know that?
Okay. That's an intriguing question. Do we think that Ants knows that Jules is not his son? Do we have any indication in the text?
I haven't seen an indication. I've been looking for his son.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's so self-absorbed. Like I don't even know if he would notice. Like he doesn't even notice if his wife's having an affair because he's sitting around thinking about his teeth and being a jerk.
Right.
Well, yeah, that'll do it. Also, you know, like maybe a cause and effect there, like, you know, look in the mirror right. much.
Thank you. Yep.
Although if I didn't have teeth, maybe I wouldn't want to look in the mirror either.
The mirror. So
the two of you come down hard on ants. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like the opposite. I was just thinking a lot while reading about where the sympathies of this book seem to be coming down on these different characters. Like, you know, this isn't a book that has a clear villain. It's not a book that has you come away from it like feeling like there's a clear hero either. Mm. There's a problem and there's a group of people and they're all suffering in various ways. And so I've been thinking a lot about where does the book itself, like as an entity, not you know, how does Ants feel about so forth? How do the different points of view care about the different other characters? But how does the book as an entity feel about the different characters? So where do you think the book, and we'll just say Faulkner if that's easier, where do you think his sympathies are with these different characters? Like, who does the book seem to sympathize the most and the least with? That might be the easiest. Maybe that's not the easiest, but what do you think about that, Sam? I just could, you know, these characters are going through so much and they're making so many bad choices and they're so unsure of what's happening and they don't know what choices to make. And so even when they're making bad choices, you kind of feel like, well, what's the alternative in a lot of times? Like, they don't have a lot of options. Yeah. So where do you fall on this question?
I think high on the list of sympathies is Dewey Dell. Mm. I think that the scene in the drugstore is just heartbreaking.
The last section
heartbreaking.
Yeah. That's the Mosley perspective.
Yeah, that's the Mosley perspective. And this poor girl is just so lost. And she mean, I get the drugstore owner has like a moral conviction about what she wants. I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But man, just no sympathy with this poor girl's plight.
Yeah.
And more and more, I just have so much sympathy with her plight.
Do you get the sense that she knows what it is that she has been sent to ask for?
That's a great question.
Mm. Like the particulars, like they say, it's don't worry, go get this medicine. It'll be fine.
No, she thinks I get the sense. She thinks it's like a pill, like a magic pill, something that will be easy. And I don't think she thinks of it as an operation of some kind, mm-hmm. or anything that, yeah, I think she just thinks it's like magic, right? She's almost like a, I don't know, like she lives almost like a very like medieval life, like a yeah. maiden in a village, you know,
that's just a great
like
point,
doesn't
yeah.
know what's up. And
yeah.
Yeah, she's very, to Tim's point, she's very pathetic and like the sense of pathos pathetic, not in the sense of like, ew, pathetic. Like she just right. has yeah. this yeah. like helplessness.
Not in the way that ants is pathetic.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right. Like there's just this helplessness and this fragility to her, and this like all of her defenses are up and she's unkind, but it's like an animal in a trap kind of. Mm-hmm. It's yeah, she's like terribly tragic figure.
I have a question for you, Heidi. Mm-hmm. Do you think, we think that she's only like maybe 2 months pregnant. At least that's what she says to Mosley. Mm-hmm. And maybe that might be kind of wishful thinking. Maybe she's a little bit farther along, but regardless, my question is, do you think that if Addie had not been sick during the last 2 months, that she could have talked honestly with her daughter? Would her daughter have been able to talk honestly with her about the pregnancy?
That's a great maybe. Question, because we get one chapter of
only one Addie's of POV. Addie. And we, you yeah. know, it's really interesting. It's such a good question. And it opens up a whole other, I think, line of conversation and speculation between the three of us, because we actually get very little sense of any of her children's relationship, actual particulars of their relationship with their mother, with the exception of Jewel. But even with Jewel, we don't really get to know. All everybody knows is that Jewel was mom's favorite, and that Jewel yeah. was selfish and didn't have the same attachment to his mother that his mother had to him. Although I'm not sure the evidence of the text completely bears that out either. But we do know that everybody perceives Jewel as Addie's favorite, although Ants seems to have no thoughts at all about his wife other than as relates to him. Or sense of any relationship within the family. But I do get the sense that Addie, of course, has a very deep, like a deep and abiding tragic knowledge of the plight of women in the world. And in within her cultural context. And that makes me think that perhaps she'd be able to meet Dewey Dell in her plight yeah. and forge a relationship that they hadn't really had before, because Addie specifically says that Dewey Dell belongs to Ants and not to her. Right. And was given, you know, she's trade, it's transaction, right? Like I had Jewel and Jewel was what I had, and I gave him all the rest of my kids. And that is, or at least three out of the other four. And so there's a sense of renunciation of motherhood on her part. But I'd like to think that that might have formed a bond between them, although that's pure speculation.
When you read that section, Heidi, from Addie's POV, mm-hmm. how sympathetic are you to her?
Mm.
She's a hard woman. Yeah. And yet she's been through hard things. And that makes how you think about her so difficult. You know, it's, you know, when I read something like, I'm working on this, I'm about to go to this event on Wendell Berry. And one of the things that we're doing is we're going to talk about Hannah Coulter. And people who have read Hannah Coulter know that there is like, Hannah Coulter endures just horrific, terrible you know, hardship. She lives a very hard life. And yet there's a grace to her that makes her very appealing and makes her like imitate, you know, someone who is worthy of imitation and praise and things like that. Here you have this character who has been through so much and you feel for her. And yet that she is so hard-hearted makes it hard to sympathize with her totally. So I'd love to know where you fall on that continuum of like sympathy for what she's been through and criticizing her or whatever word you want to use for how hard-hearted she is.
I think I don't have a visceral reaction of judgment towards her that I do have towards ants. So, because she has endured a lot and she didn't have any help in that, but neither did ants. It's so funny. Like I can't always identify why I feel sympathetic towards, I just like hate ants so much. Mm. And I have like no glimmer of grace for him. And that's, I'm sure, a flaw in me I also don't think that Faulkner really gives us much there. Like he doesn't even what we have from his perspective is entirely selfish. And so we don't get kind of the behind the curtain on ants, but with Addie, we do. Yeah. However, so I do not have the visceral reaction of judgment towards her. However, I can't, if I look at it from the perspective of her children, I do cast judgment upon her. And I mean that differently than just, I like immediately write her off, but I look at that and I think like that is like, you have done a terrible thing. Like you've done a terrible thing to your children and that's on you as a woman, because it is a mom's job to lay her life down for her children. That is like, no matter how you feel, no matter what, that is motherhood. That is the nature of motherhood. That's the great hardship and the great glory of motherhood. And the fact that she doesn't do that makes me, as you know, kind of like sisterhood of moms kind of thing, say like, then you have, like inflicted a wound that you can never take back. And in that sense, I cast judgment upon that. But as a woman who is part of, again, the sisterhood of women, like I look at her and I like, I get it. Your life is really hard. And like, who is there to care for you and love you? That was Ant's job and he failed. And so like that you just get caught up in the tragedy of this family and it's complicated. My reactions are complex, emotionally reflecting the complexity of the characters. And I'd like to think that that's appropriate. My most simple reaction though is towards Ant's. I hate that guy.
Noted. Again, Tim, so how do you feel about her?
I think the compare and contrast with Hannah Coulter, I think, is a really fruitful one. Like, they grew up in probably very similar years in American history. They grew up even in similar places. Mm-hmm. Like, I assume Hannah Coulter is Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Addie is Mississippi. So, you know, a similar part of the world. I find it so much easier to sympathize with... No, let me back up. There's not that kind of bitterness in Hannah Coulter that we find in Addie. Part of the reason why is that Coulter is... She's been surrounded by basically trustworthy people. Right? I mean, her first husband is kind of emotionally cold and she, you know, wishes that they had a warmer relationship. But basically her moral universe is stable. And I think that it's kind of a luxury that Hannah has that it doesn't seem like Addie has. Like in Addie's world, the person she most needs to depend on, her husband, is just, I think to call him a layabout is a compliment. You know, he's kind of aggressively sluggish. He is as torpid as a wet sponge. And I think that I can really sympathize with Addie for developing a kind of like bitterness. I also think the affair with a pastor, even though she's a willing accomplice, I think it does something kind of to her conscience. You know, that this man of the cloth, supposedly, even if he chose her, I still think there's kind of like a, but gosh, you're not really who you say you are.
And
right. So, and I think that like takes a real toll on her.
So that gives you more sympathy for her plight.
It gives me a lot more sympathy with her. Right. Right.
Hmm. You know, you look at the Mosley chapter and he's talking to the sheriff and the people in the town. It's this pretty small town. And yet all these people in the town look at them like they're, you know, savages, like they're animals or something like that. So do you think that the book itself, what do you make of the degree to which the book seems to make them seem helpless or animalistic or lacking in civilization or whatever it is? I don't know exactly what phrase to use. It doesn't, you know, there's a difference between even them and like rural Mississippi town folk, you know, and they look at, you know, they look at this family like they're animals, like they're savages. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it puts us in a bind of saying, well, how do we look at them? So do you think the book is sympathetic with how sort of uncivilized they are, or is it criticizing that? Or is it, I mean, is it just a documentary? You know, is it just sort of realism at work? I mean, how do you think about that in terms of the way the book is portraying the sort of lack of civilization that they have?
Right. I think that it is showing that to us as a critique of, as a cultural critique, not as a critique on the individuals, although they're not really very likable, right? Like, and
right. That's the hard thing.
Right. And I think that's where Faulkner's genius really lies. I think it's Dewey Dell who is the most, who's presented as the most, in the most like bestial language. And, and her inner life is the most simplistic. But she's compared to a cow, like a milk cow. And yet she's the one that, like Tim, you've expressed like such deep sympathy for her. And I think we all feel that. So there, that it seems very clear to me that Faulkner is asking us to look at them with compassion rather than straightforward judgment, and to look at the kind of society and circumstances that would dehumanize an entire family and by extension group of people within a culture to that degraded extent.
You mentioned that she gets like described like in animal terms.
Yes.
Is that when Mosley describes her leaving the room as her feet making a little hissing on the floor? Which is a pretty intense image, and you even get the sense of like sort of a snake, you know, that he sees her as this sort of like evil, demonic figure. This character Mosley does, not Faulkner, and they look at them like animals, like creatures.
When he wants to help her and. Like he has like a very fatherly kind of response to her at the beginning, which to be honest is the only, he's the only man that we see that isn't spoken of as having a perceived sexual attraction towards her. Like it's very clear from the language that he's not lusting after her. He's thinking of her in a very fatherly kind of way. And I don't think the other men, I don't think necessarily the other men have sexualized her. I think that's her perception of men because that's how she's been treated by Leif. But I think that she is used to being treated a certain way by a man and doesn't know what to do with his kindness towards her. But he does then at the end, he does kind of turn on her there. But he wants it first to help her. And he asks her where her mom is. And she says out in the wagon. That was really sad. Like, just that whole chapter is so like pulls on your heartstrings.
You know, there's so little sympathy in this book from anyone to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody is out fending for themselves. I think about, like, no one has a word of grace for Vardaman. No one has a word of grace for
he's just getting shouted at all the time.
What'd you say, David?
Vardaman's just getting shouted at all the time.
Right, right. The youngest character in the book, the one who needs like the most help or the most gentleness, he gets nothing. And it seems like the strongest bond of sympathy in the whole book is between the reader and the family.
Mm.
I mean, hopefully that's what the bond is between us and them.
People do try to help. I mean, and I think Tull has a connection with Vardaman. He calls him the boy and he holds his hand when they're crossing the bridge.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
But to your point,
they are trying, but Ants is rejecting them.
To your point, it's all outside of the family.
Yeah. Right?
And it's all being all of that kind. This is why I dislike Ants so much. Is any kind of gentleness or kindness that's being showed towards them, he shuts down because he wants his teeth.
Yeah.
Any kind of hope for like any kind of like neighborly feeling, any membership type feeling, which it does seem like some of the neighbors have that, right? The way Tull is, he's there. He doesn't have to be there. He's there out of kindness. That's Samson's there. Like there are these people who are trying to help this family, and the women feeling so helpless and like, why don't you come in and let us make you a meal and you can stay in our barn. Like they don't want to stay. The women don't want them to stay in the barn. They want them to come inside and sit down at a meal to share it. They're trying to be neighborly and they're getting shut down by Ants all the time.
It seems like Ants, the reason he shuts it down is because he perceives everything as condescension.
Yeah.
And he's too prideful to accept that, to accept like a help, because that would mean that he is who he is, which is like just incapable.
Mm-hmm. He can't abide by the idea that there might be something he can't do for himself.
Right. Even though every minute in this book, he's not providing for anyone. I think that's part of what like drives me so crazy about him.
And his pride is creating a barrier between the community and his children.
Exactly. One of my favorite scenes in the book was the revelation that Jewel was sneaking off. They all thought, oh, he's going and he's having an affair and he's not telling us because it's probably with the married woman. Mm-hmm. And then we find out, no, he was actually like working at night clearing the field. Yeah. And I love the exchange between Jewel and Ants when Ants is kind of like, I mean, Ants punishes him for taking the initiative, clearing this field at night. He's basically like, so you earned a horse. That's another mouth to feed, instead of, oh my goodness, how impressive. You worked so hard. You earned this extra money. You've now earned a horse. No, he immediately goes into a complaining bench like, well, how are we going to feed it? And Jewel immediately snaps to and says, like, basically, my horse is never going to eat a single oat of yours. He'll sooner die. You know, like, I'll take care of this, Dad. Like, I actually know how to kind of provide for myself. I'll provide for the horse. I really like Jewel. I know he is a hard, hard man, but man, as we get deeper into the book, I have more sympathy because I think he's actually kind of soft-hearted. Mm. And he has that kind of armor plating around him because he is so soft-hearted. Yeah. I don't think he's going to repeat the mistakes of his dad. Well, his pseudo-dad.
Yeah.
I think he's going to live a different kind of life. I'm not sure that it's going to be a happy life, a joyful life, but I think he's going to live a different kind of life.
I think the reason that Ants can just give away the horse goes back to what you were saying, Heidi, like Ants doesn't, he doesn't put in the work. He doesn't put in the work that Jewel puts in to earn the horse. So he doesn't value the horse. Like he can just give it away because it's not something that he had to lift a finger to get or to care about. That he doesn't, you know, he hasn't put any effort in that would cause him to love the thing or to value the thing. It's just a commodity to,
don't you think he hates the horse because it's symbolic of his son having more potential than him and becoming independent? So I think that's that when I texted you guys that I sent you that text after he had sold Jules' horse, traded it for the mules, even that act, right, of trading a horse and everything that the family owns of value for mules, which are a sign of independence, yes, but also poverty, right? Like it's the poor farmers who have mules, not horses, right? And so the way he's exchanging everything that sets Jewel apart so that he can just become, so he can bring him back in line. I think he hates that horse. And that's why I think Jewel's mother is a horse. Like that's all like so tied up with Addie and Addie's betrayal, which feels like, which Ants has absorbed that sense of betrayal and takes it out on Jewel's horse, which is how his mother is a horse. And that like that kind of complex, like interplay of dependence and independence that Jewel is constantly wrestling with throughout this entire novel, because he's different than all the other kids, biologically different and also different in all these other symbolic ways. And the horse is like carries the weight of all of that. And so all Ants wants to do is get rid of that horse, get it out of the family. Everything is wrong with it. Like the horse carries the weight of all of that. It even carries the weight of that with Jewel, because Jewel abuses that horse. He loves it and he hurts it all at the same time. He's constantly punching it. He is constantly cruel to his horse. And yet it's everything he loves, which goes to his own self-loathing. Like it's a very, man, it's dark
symbolically
right now.
Rich.
It's so weighted, right? And a horse is so masculine and has such a weight of which we talked about when we did all the pretty horses. Like it has like this weight of male sexuality on the symbolism of it as well. And oh man, that just my mother is a horse is that's a big thing. That's a big thing in this book.
You know, one thing that I've noticed about us on close reads is when there's a book that has really well-drawn characters, we tend to not ask questions about... I want to check that. I started to say we tend to not ask questions about motives and actions, but we just take these characters as kind of like fully formed human beings and discuss, you know, why they did this and why they did this. Whereas in some of the books that I feel like the characters were less well drawn, we spend a lot more time trying to understand like, okay, who exactly is this and what exactly are they doing? I don't know that I'm being very clear about what I see, but these characters are so bright right now. And I think it took a little while for me to see just how brightly drawn they are, because the method of the storytelling is so novel and it's not always simple to read, as we talked about in the first couple of episodes. But by the time that we, you know, cross the river with this family, all the kind of fractures between these characters and their propensities as human beings just seems so clear to me. And it sounds like to you guys also.
Do you think that the characters are meant to be intelligent?
Some of them are, yes. I think Jewel's really intelligent. Darl obviously is very intelligent. I think that Cash and Dewey Dell are probably just pretty simple people, but still have been denied so much that that has just denied their opportunity to develop into, like, I think if they were in a Wendell Berry novel, they would be like, just like really good people, like good ordinary people, right? Like a farmer's wife and a farmer, and they would be honorable like
Ernest
people.
Ernest Finley or something.
Yes. And Vardaman is, I mean, he's still a child, but he does seem to have some special needs. But I think one of the whole points is that, like, there's this big weight of emotion, this big, I mean, they're all human and all humans have a capacity for a depth and a richness of humanity. And the language for that and the framework for that has been denied to these people. And because of that, they're like, Jules' intelligence is actually just turned into cruelty, right? Like Ants, instead of becoming an industrious and a hardworking man, has become turned more and more inward and become more and more self-indulgent and narcissistic or whatever, although that word's way overused, self-absorbed. I do think that some of them could have been really, really intelligent people and just have been denied.
A question along those lines. Somebody asked on the Facebook page, do we think that the vocabulary of some of these characters, I'm thinking about Darl especially, kind of outpaces their education level?
I think some of the vocabulary just outpaces most of our education level.
Right.
I don't know. I was thinking about that
too. But wait. I don't know that that's... Is that an answer, David?
Well, no, but it's not. No, I think that, I was thinking about that a lot too, like with Darl, but I don't know if we can answer that without really knowing how, like, were there people that spoke that way that had read a lot of the King James Bible, despite the fact that they lived in rural, you know, Mississippi? That's the tougher thing for me to answer with any kind of... Feeling like I actually can answer the question, because on the one hand, it does seem like his vocabulary as a point of view of the story outpaces what he would have likely been like. But then that's just a sense that I have living in 2022, not like any real knowledge. I mean, how do you seem to have some opinions on Darl's narration and the way he presents himself and the way it may or may not be realistic. He implied some things like that in the first episode. What do you think about it?
I mean, what we don't know is where this narrative is coming from, right? And meaning, Darl writes in the present tense and then he switches into the past tense at various times in his narrative. And it's Darl's narrative that we get the italics, which have always puzzled readers, right? And are used in a very fluid way. And we haven't talked too much about that, that particular writing choice of Faulkner's. But it seems clear to me that Darl's narrative has been written from a later time, remembering this time. It is a memory novel. And so it's possible that some of his vocabulary on a practical level is coming from future education that he did not have at the time that this was happening. Right. And so there, that's one possibility. And then the other possibility is that it's not intended to be realistic as much as it's intended to give us a glimpse into a more sophisticated mind within the family, which is why everyone thinks he's a weirdo. Right.
I just want to read a section from Darl. For me, it's on page 141. Before us, the thick, dark current runs. It talks up to us in a murmur, became ceaseless and myriad. The yellow surface dimpled monstrously into fading swirls, traveling along the surface for an instant, silent, impermanent, and profoundly significant, as though just below the surface, something huge and alive waked for a moment of lazy alertness out of and into light slumber again. It clucks and murmurs among the spokes about the mule's knees, yellow, scummed with flotsam and with thick soiled gouts of foam, as though it had sweat, lathering like a driven horse. Through the undergrowth it goes with a plaintive sound, a musing sound. In it, the unwinded cane and saplings lean as before a light gale, swaying without reflection as though suspended on invisible wires from the branches overhead. Above the ceaseless surface they stand, trees, cane, vines, rootless, severed from the earth, spectral above a scene of immense yet circumscribed desolation, filled with the voice of the waste and mournful water. That's amazing. That's really amazing. It seems like that's written in the kind of present tense of experience and not reflecting back on, it doesn't seem like it's a distant memory. It seems very immediate. And it also seems to me like it really does outpace his education level. I mean, just conceptually, mm-hmm. maybe not his vocabulary, but conceptually, that's really advanced, just like a thoughtful seeing of the world. And so
agreed.
The person who posted on Facebook, I wish I could remember who it was.
Susan.
I need to give
you. It was Susan.
Susan Johnson?
Yeah, Susan Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. One of our kind of great readers. Then I agree with Susan, but for some reason it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
I think it's
not a flaw.
No, and I think it's not almost a flaw.
It's entirely intentional. That's one of those things that my students would be like, did they do that on purpose? I'm like, yeah, it's Faulkner.
Yeah,
he totally
did
it on purpose. And he had a better reason than we could ever think of. Yes. So all of that.
So it's like Faulkner, I think, recognized, yeah, his interior monologue is going to outpace his actual education. But this is how I show that Darl has this really rich inner life. Like a very poetic kind of sensibility. And I read those sections and I don't think this isn't realistic. I think Darl is a man of a profound feeling.
And that's the language that shows us that.
Yeah.
The chosen language that gives us a glimpse into that mind, into that kind of like mythopoeic connection with the other members of the family and with the world.
Exactly.
I think by way of clarity, I might pick a nit with what you're saying, so to speak. I think it is the expression of the inner life that outpaces the education, not the inner life, which is being outpacing the education.
Wait, what's the difference?
Because
go on.
The inner life is observation. He's just seeing, and he sees what other people don't see. So like you know, before us, the thick, dark current runs. It talks up to us and a murmur becomes ceaseless and myriad. The yellow surface dimpled monstrously into fading swirls, traveling along the surface for an instant, silent, impermanent, and profoundly significant, as though just beneath the surface, something huge and alive waked for a moment of lazy alertness out of and into light slumber again. Like he's seeing images. Like his imagination is at work, and it's the expression, it's the words that he's choosing to express those images that would outpace the education, not the sense that he's just seeing images. Like at the end of, on 145, much later, Jewel and Vernon are in the river again. From here, they do not appear to violate the surface at all. It is as though it had severed them both at a single blow. The two torsos moving with infinitesimal and ludicrous care upon the surface. It looks peaceful, like machinery does after you've watched it and listened to it for a long time, as though the clotting, which is you, had dissolved into the myriad original motion, and seeing and hearing in themselves blind and deaf, fury in itself quiet with stagnation. Squatting, Duidel's wet dress shapes for the dead eyes of three blind men those mammalian ludicrosities which are the horizons and the valleys of the earth. So yeah, Cormac McCarthy.
Mammalian
so
ludicrosities.
Forth.
I know. It's so Cormac McCarthy.
So like what's happening is he is seeing an image and he's, his imagination is taking that image. And it's like, he's saying, like, for example, it looks like the two torsos are moving with care upon the surface. Like they're moving very carefully and slowly. And then he begins to expand on that idea, and his imagination is taking it, but the way that he expresses it, that the words that he's choosing to express those images are what maybe outpace the education. But I don't think that people, what the degree to which you have education determines your ability to see an image.
Oh, I think I disagree. I think that, and I think the more education or the sort of like more nourishment of the internal self we have, I do think that we actually
Be two different things.
Agree. They could be different things, but I don't think that Case could see what Darl sees.
But is it, but
even though he's looking at the same like data, I don't think he could see what Darl is seeing.
So then is it like magical realism to make these two? I mean, they're just different people.
Right.
One of them has a deeper inner life than the other. One is very practical. He's about making sure that things lay flat in wagons. You know, he's about measurements and planes and step by steps. And Darl has this rich imagination. But is that a function of... They're both being left behind. They're two different capacities are being left behind, which is one of the, by the culture, by their family, by the, you know, the lack of nourishment, which is one of the great tragedies of the book. Everybody has their own way of, their own individual way of seeing the world, and it's all being left without nourishment. But is that because I guess what I'm saying is I don't know that I think it has anything to do in this book with education.
Are we asking like nature versus nurture? Is it like, Tim, does Darl have an innate capacity to see and like to see something mystical, something mysterious, something beyond the veil? Does he have that innate capacity?
Can you have that without education?
Well, I'm just asking, even just, does he have that in a different way than Cash does in your mind, in your interpretation?
He might. For me, the nature nurture question, I mean, it's definitely relevant, but I think for me, the reason that Darl has capacity is because he's invested in seeing the
world.
Because
he's paying attention.
In a ritual. Yeah,
because
he's
like
paying
awake.
Attention. Yeah.
He's awake.
Right. So does that mean he's like better educated? Well, okay, sort of. I mean, but does that mean that he went to more schooling than Cash? I probably doubt it. I just mean that the word investing is probably like the best word.
Sure, but I agree with all that. I guess I'm taking issue with the idea that we should even have a discussion about whether it bothers us. Because you were like, it outpaces his education, but it doesn't bother me. Like, what I'm saying is whether it bothers us or not, it's irrelevant. It's not a function of, like, the book doesn't care about that.
Well, but I think I don't want to put words in your mouth, Tim, and you're perfectly capable of speaking for yourself. But what I thought you were saying was, like, what I heard was, it works. It's not a flaw. It's like, it is, Faulkner did it on purpose for a really, really good reason. So it's not a failure that Darl speaks beyond his education.
But the fact that, I mean, I thought the same thing that Susan thought. Like, I thought, wait a second, is this?
Me too. Yeah.
You know, okay. Well, and I'll just to, by contrast, I did not think that when I read Cormac McCarthy. And I think part of the reason why is because of the position of the narrator. Faulkner has positioned his narrator very, very close to the people telling the story, right? With McCarthy, that narrator is a little bit more distant. So the narrator himself, which is this kind of like third party, is the one who speaks most eloquently, while his characters, who are cowboys, speak with just... We don't get their inner life. We only get their... Mm-hmm. What they say. And so that kind of, we don't have, that's the way that Cormac McCarthy solved the problem that I think Susan raised on the Facebook page.
What I'm saying is I think everybody has a degree of eloquence in their inner life, no matter who you are and where you come from, that is expressed based on the circumstances that you come from and what, and the nourishment that's been given to that inner life. And so what I don't think that his inner life goes beyond his capacity. I think it's, again, I think it's the expression, like that's where the vocabulary I think does come into play.
Okay. So I'm having kind of a new question then, because I had made an assumption that could be completely wrong. My assumption was that the characters were writing this story, that the narrators are the people who they claim to be, right? Like Dewey Dell sat down and wrote something, right? And Darl sat down and wrote something. But now I'm wondering if that's not true. Maybe we, like, who is the narrator of this story?
There's a difference between a narrator, though, and a cult. So the narrators are the narrators who they, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
I haven't read an authoritative take on this from Faulkner or something. My take is the characters are who they say they are. But Faulkner, the book itself is a sort of, he's the collection point of those points of view. And that's why it doesn't matter if there's consistency or inconsistency between them. Like they can talk about different themes. They can have different concerns. They can have different things that matter to them. The plot points can even be presented in different ways because the book itself is a collection of disparate points of view. And so that's why one of the things you have to settle into is the dissonances of the perspectives. And that's what makes it difficult. So I don't even think about it that way is maybe what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, you don't think about it what way?
The way Heidi was kind of presenting the original thought.
I think you're more right than me. Like, I think you're right. Like, I think I have a pretty systematic, almost, you remember like early novels, how they were all epistolary and then they had to like create kind of like explanation for how the manuscript got in their hands and they put that as a framing, you know, like Frankenstein, right?
Frankenstein.
Like that kind of thing. Like the story within a story. And I think I had
like a framing device to give you a sense of realism about it.
There's somebody who's compiling the story of Addie's death and journey to Jefferson. And I didn't even think about the fact that I was assuming that, but now I'm thinking that's not right. Like it's just, we have this magical account of the inner life of these people, almost like a photograph, that it doesn't matter where it came from. It doesn't. And so in that sense, it seems appropriate to me that Darl's language, because he has such a sophisticated, mystical, mythopoeic mind. And so it seems appropriate that the language used to describe it is of a higher order than the language used to describe from another character's point of view who does not have that capacity within them or that whatever that is within them, doesn't have the same kind of mind as Darl. And we don't have to explain that in any kind of like scientific sense that makes sense for it. We don't have to provide a justification for how the manuscript came into our hands, so to speak.
The only thing I would say is I don't think that we get the point of view of the characters who are not capable of expressing it.
Go on.
Like we don't really get a lot of Anse's mind.
Right. True.
Well, I don't know, David. We get a lot from Vardaman.
Yeah, I think Vardaman. I would argue that Vardaman does see. He is the 6-year-old version of what Darl of what Darl may have been when he was 6. Like he's the world in sort of a immature, fledgling mythopoeic way. Like hence, my mother is a fish. Like, I just think
and
that he
goes straight to the heart of Jewel's mother as a horse. Does he see, is he the same? Do you guys see him the same as Darl as having kind of a special insight? Or is he just a child trying to make sense of trauma?
What's the difference?
I think the latter. I think he's a child trying to make sense of trauma. I'm not sure. I can imagine Cash talking in the same way at his at Vardaman's age.
But Cash, David, is. You see him. I will not take this Cash slander.
I will not take this cash slander sitting down. I rise to oppose.
But if I stand up, then you won't be able to hear me because I'll be above the microphone.
I totally think that he might have the, like, one day become more like Darl than like Cash. I just don't think we, I think it's kind of like too early to tell.
I mean, that's fine. That I accept. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think kind of the incredible thing about this book is that we can, we can have these conversations and like kind of never exhaust them.
True.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to kind of get out what you're trying to say because there is this sort of myth, this poetry that's kind of underlying it all that you can't just, mm-hmm. you can't just synthesize into like a systematic theology of the book or whatever. What's the literary version of a systematic theology, right? There is a mystery in these relationships and at the core of this book that is very difficult to put language to in a logical way.
Agreed.
And so much of it is like our own experiences, right? Because you're kind of like, you're trying to get out how you're responding to characters. You have to read this. I think we have to read this book 20 times and sort of, to use the word again, synthesize 20 different personal experiences that we're having with it to begin to really know anything about it, you know? I think that's why it's great, is because so much of it is about what we experience with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in the sense like it's all relative, but he is inviting us by the nature of the story to experience it different with every chapter and every reading and like hang out in that mystery.
Right. I think you're so right, Dave.
That's totally true.
I was looking for work at kind of some classical paintings that we might use for a client's kind of visual presentation. And I saw one of the old Jacques-Louis David paintings, kind of classical romantic painting of Horatio's Oath, like these three guys holding out their hands toward a collection of swords. And it's very, even if you don't know where the scene comes from literarily, there's a kind of like a sense that this is a moment of kind of like oath taking. And then we flipped over in this work meeting to Jackson Pollock's paintings. And Jackson Pollock most definitely composed. These are not random. He most definitely composed. However, because it's not figurative, we do tend to kind of like put more of ourselves into the meaning of the painting, right? And I think that this book has more in common with a Jackson Pollock painting than it does a Jacques-Louis David painting. To your point, David, we like kind of tend to, I find myself doing this all the time. I tend to import or paste more meaning on this book than I would a Wendell Berry book.
You mean because the book is, you mean import more meaning?
Because it's more impressionistic.
Yeah,
you're right. Because it's more abstract.
Yeah.
We have to kind of like, I think it requires more of us to kind of like tie things together. Even though I think that the characters are so strongly drawn, it still seems like it's much more of a modern painting than a classical painting, a classical representational painting.
One of the things that I'm going to talk about in this Barry thing that I'm doing this weekend is like how much Barry hates abstractions. Like to make a person or a place into an abstraction is to dehumanize them. It's like the fundamental problem of the modern age to Barry. And here we have this book that's very abstract, and yet do the characters feel like abstractions? Like formally it feels abstract.
Not at all. Right. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a difference. Like Faulkner's not making this place of these people into like data points, which could easily be done in a book about poor people from Yakunapatawpha, Mississippi, right? It just becomes like a documentary about, you know, to like make some kind of social
the poor
study out of them. Yeah. Go ahead, Heidi. What were you gonna say?
No, just that. I mean, it's like what we talked about last week in our last conversation about Heidegger, that he is that
we did talk about Heidegger. That's right.
Yeah. That we have with Heidegger, you have a lot of abstractions, which some people really like there's, you who really loves to read Heidegger is Andrew John Kern, your brother. Like,
yeah, my
he really
brother,
likes
yeah.
Heidegger. But he is a very philosophical mind. Right. And so he enjoys that. And it like that draws him in. And an abstraction can feel safe because it's universal, and then you get to make a judgment on it, right? Like whether you agree with it or disagree with it, or whether you think it's true or not true, right? But a person is, and a person's experiences are not something you can argue with. And I think that that's, you can argue whether or not the person's making a judgment, a right judgment about the data point of their circumstances, right? But Faulkner is much, it's much better to read Faulkner if you're having a question of identity, in my opinion, than to read Heidegger, because with Faulkner, you have people inhabiting the abstractions, right? And bringing their own personal experiences into it. And so then you have something more than just an idea, you have a person, and that makes these kind of lofty philosophical, metaphysical questions, they make them real, right? It's not just a rabbit, right? It's the Velveteen Rabbit who's becoming real,
yeah.
Right? And that yeah. is like that, that's what I think is so powerful about fiction. Is it kind of forces us to reckon and wrestle with the fact that we're not just talking about being in time, but about children who've lost their mom.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a,
hey,
Barry says that there's a difference between fact and truth, right?
Yeah.
Just because something, sometimes there's things that are truer than facts. Go ahead, Tim. You
exactly.
gotta go.
No, I was just going to say, do you know that Heidegger shows up in a Flannery O'Connor short story?
Which one?
Good Country People. Joy Hulga, the girl.
The Bible salesman who steals the lady's woman wooden leg. Yeah. I love that story.
Right, right. It's such a great story. And Joy Hulga is reading like this dense piece of philosophy, yeah. and she leaves the book on some coffee table, and her mom picks it up and she reads a section from Heidegger, and it's so abstract. That's it's right. just crazy out there. And I wish I could remember what the mom says in response, but something like, what in the world is this girl putting in her mind? You know, something like that. I wish I could find it. Maybe by next week, since Heidegger has become a star of this series of podcasts, I can find that section. That might be fun.
This idea of abstraction, I think, is fascinating, and I've been thinking about it a lot because I've been kind of like obsessed with the painter Wayne Thiebaud. Do you guys know him?
No.
He just died on Christmas Day, actually, at like age 102. You've probably seen his paintings. You spell it T-H-I-E-B-A-U-D, and he has a lot of famous paintings of like the cakes. You may have seen the cakes painting or different food paintings that he did, lollipops and ice cream and all kinds of stuff like that. Gumball machines. And he did hundreds and hundreds of, he did New Yorker covers and things like that. And there's this precision to his work. Sometimes they're quite colorful, lots of balance. One of my favorite paintings of him, he's got some great landscapes, but one of my favorite paintings he did is this coffee mug. And if you ever want to look at a painting with kids and talk about shape and talk about how many circles are in this very simple painting of a tan coffee mug with black, well, maybe there's a little milk in it, with coffee in it. It's a great conversation you could have with little kids about art. But I love these paintings because there is a sense of abstraction to them, and yet there's a sense of realism to them, and there's a sense of whimsy to them. And all of these things come together at the same time. So, you know, these are modern paintings. The modern brushstrokes, the modern lines, the modern use of color and shape and modern images, like you'd see on a... Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Heidi's holding it up right now. And yet there is this sense of abstraction too, like when you see 42 cakes in this painting or 42 pieces of lemon meringue pie or whatever it is. And so something can be abstract and full of realism at the same time. I've been thinking about... that kind of fine line a lot because I've been sort of obsessed with these paintings. And I feel like in some ways Faulkner, like he kind of pulls that off. There's this real sense of abstraction and yet it's very lived in and real, you know, it's realism, mm-hmm. but it doesn't put too fine a point on it. You know, it allows you to sort of like the mystery to be there. And I don't mean to suggest that Wayne Thiebaud and William Faulkner are either on the same playing field as artists or dealing in trading in the same things. But just an idea I've been thinking about, the way that you can have like a sense of realism and a sense of abstraction intertwined in the same work of art. I'm just kind of mm-hmm. interested in that. And I think that's maybe one of the things that the truly great works of art do is that like when they become magical is because they're taking realism and they're taking abstraction and they're twisting them together and you're not always able to separate them.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah, that's good.
I can see that.
So good.
Tim, any final thoughts before we go? That was my final thought.
Yeah. I am really looking forward to the conclusion of this book. It's really sad. I'm hoping that someone makes it out alive. You know what I mean? It just feels like this family feels like a death trap.
Ugh.
And like the stench, by the way, like the stench as a, like kind of like following them through the town is such a potent way of like describing how everybody feels about them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like they have the odor of death on them.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting because it's gone from the birds following them and like being predators to that scent had moved on to the people. And the people kind of hover around them and are disgusted.
Yeah.
Heidi, what about you?
I have three final thoughts. Number one, this book is really sad. And it's sad. And I think that if I hadn't mm-hmm. have had to record a podcast on it today, I would have like stopped in the middle of the reading mm-hmm. and like come back to it because it's just so heavy. And so and I'm like really loving this book, but I think I forgot how sad it was. The second thing is that one thing we didn't talk about today, which was amazing, was the description of the water.
That section that I read was about the water.
Well, we didn't talk about it though. That's what I'm saying. And so I just want to say like, it was just like the water with the logs rising up out of it.
Oh
my gosh.
You're talking about like the action sequence when they're trying to.
It was amazing.
Great.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Some of the best writing I've read in a long time. And then my third final thought is, I just want to reiterate that Ants is such an ass. And that's my final thought.
So to recap, this book is sad. The water scene was awesome. Mm-hmm. Ants is an ass. That's it.
One, two, three. Yeah. Bullet points.
Heidi wants to jump through into the book and kick Ants in the ants. Him.
I would like to kick that guy in the ants. I would. Yeah.
That should be a new thing. Like you want to kick someone in the ants when they're not.
Insert your favorite Christian substitute here.
Yeah. We keep it bad dads. Family friendly. I love it.
Yeah. Close reads friendly. All right. Well. Yeah, that you're right though. That scene it's like an incredible action scene. Okay, that's it. Yeah, we're now looking at Heidi. Heidi's looking up Wayne Thiebaud paintings.
There's one called Pancake Breakfast. I just really like it.
Yeah, it's great. He makes these amazing food paintings. Great landscape paintings. He's kind of in like if you like Edward Hopper, he's mm-hmm. like the next. He's like you. Once you like Edward Hopper, go look at Wayne Thiebaud paintings.
I do recognize a few of these, but go look at the one called Pancake Breakfast.
Tim's leaving.
Just makes me want to eat pancakes.
We're just chatting about Wayne Thiebaud now. Tim's gone. Okay. Well, go look at Wayne Thiebaud paintings. Well, that's it. For Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to the Center for Lit and Bibliophiles for sponsoring Close Reads this month. Till next time, happy reading.
Thank you. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.